The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's April 6, 2026 edition. The front cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large white block capital lettering, superimposed upon a pale gray background. It features images of the faces of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. None of them is identified. It says the war for AI. There are 3 males and 2 females. Behind the faces of a couple of them is a U.S. flag flying. The symbolic eagle with the spread wings and the pennant kind of emblem of the U.S. stars and stripes. And then at the bottom of the page is a depiction. It looks like a drawing, but it might be a photograph from the air of the Pentagon. Leading then is the brief. Iran's Heavy Hand by Carl Vick. The regime's murderous preoccupation with preventing organized opposition. On day one, President Donald Trump urged the great proud people of Iran to take over your government. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu echoed the call in Persian. Do not let this opportunity slip away. Inside Iran, or Iran, the response has been how? Over decades, the Islamic Republic built a system designed not just to crush dissent, but to prevent it from cohering in the first place. Surveillance is pervasive. Opposition networks are infiltrated. Organizers disappear. They have killed a lot of people, says Roya Boroman, who with her sister founded the Abdurrahman Boroman Center for Human Rights in Iran, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit tallying the regime's victims. They have focused their energy on preventing their opponents from getting organized. When the U.S.-Israeli assault began, February 28, the center's staff was still trying to determine how many people were killed the last time Iranians attempted what Trump and Netanyahu are now urging. In January, throngs took to the streets, armed only with the belief that sheer numbers could topple the regime. If that sounds naively hopeful, it once worked. In 1979, millions of Iranians filled the streets as part of the Islamic Revolution that culminated in the overthrow of the Pahlavi monarchy. But those protests were mounted by organized groups, and the National Army had declared it would no longer fire on its own people. The faction of activists and clerics that ultimately took power promptly established a regime committed to preventing such mobilization from ever happening again. The state was very aware of how the Shah fell, Boroman notes. They've made sure that if they have a legitimacy problem, there's no one to fill that vacuum. First, there was hunting. Back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of assassinations, explains Mehdi Yahyanejad, an Iranian activist in the U.S. They removed important figures outside Iran. Shapur Bakhtiar, a former prime minister who attempted to organize opposition in exile, was stabbed to death in Paris in 1991. A regime hit squad also killed an associate of his, Abdurrahman Burahman, whose daughters would go on to count assassinations abroad. The current tally, 457, does not include failed attempts like the one involving a Hells Angels member who, after being hired in 2023 to kill an Iranian exile in Maryland, was arrested before he could fulfill a vow to erase his head from his torso. Nor does it count the three attempts to kill anti-regime activist Masih Alinejad. Burahman once recalled how, after a hitman was photographed on the porch of Alinejad's Brooklyn home, people were crying in like Canada, saying, "We are safe nowhere." Inside Iran, the warnings are even clearer. In the chain murders of the 1990s, dissident intellectuals were killed by axe, staged robbery, poison, and slit throats. In 1996, intelligence agents attempted to send a bus of writers over a cliff. A passenger grabbed the emergency brake after the driver leaped from the vehicle. In time, overt killings gave way to imprisonment. They killed the writers before, a Tehran movie theater manager told me in 2004. Now they put them in prison. In the section of Evin prison reserved for political prisoners, interrogators pummeled human rights advocates, journalists, and union activists with questions calculated to display the state's seeming omniscience. "They knew everything, my whole life," one of my translators explained after emerging from interrogation. When agents arrive to make an arrest, they seize phones and computers along with the suspect. "If they just held you for a week, you would be in awe," says Siamak Namazi, a dual Iranian-U.S. citizen who spent 8 years in Evin. Ordinary Iranians got the message as well. Attend a protest, and days later a text message arrives. Is it really worth it? The regime's own paranoia is not entirely unfounded. After President George W. Bush launched a program to promote democracy in Iran, a handful of activists were invited to workshops in nearby Dubai. Three returned early to Tehran after realizing they were being taught to foment the kind of grassroots revolution that in the early 2000s toppled dictatorships in Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan. Exactly what the regime was on the lookout for. Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, a student of the downfall of the Soviet Union, was intent on undercutting the building blocks of democratic civil society, from teachers' unions to an independent press. He also, after the stolen 2009 presidential election, signaled that the system was closed to reform, expanded security forces, including the head-cracking Basij militia. "The tentacles of the police state are now reaching into the far corners of the country," says Hushang Shehabi, professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. "I know people from rural areas of Iran who said, you know, in our village, we never had a presence of the government. We had a village mayor, and that was it. And now, 2 kilometers from the village, we have a little Basij base. As it stands, the most organized opposition groups may be factions that competed for power in 1979. Reza Pahlavi, eldest son of the overthrown Shah, has lived in exile in the U.S. for almost his entire life, but retains a presence in Iranian households via satellite television. His name is sometimes chanted at protests, and he has vowed to hold elections if returned to power. The Mojahideen, a Kolk, M-E-K, founded as a Marxist movement and lobbying abroad as the National Council of Resistance of Iran, announced a provisional government. but the group remains deeply unpopular inside Iran, having sided with Iraq during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Kurdish militias and political groups concentrated in western Iran also represent a form of organized opposition, but their call for an autonomous rule, if not an independent state, unnerves Iranians and raises fears of fragmentation, given the presence of other ethnic minorities within Iran's borders. All the opponents have a long history of fighting one another as well as the regime. The war, however, has ignited an effort to forge a united front. The Iran Freedom Congress is scheduled to convene in London, March 28 and 29. That would have been a couple of days ago. Preparations began between the January massacre of protesters and the February 28 start of the joint U.S.-Israeli air assault. It was something unique in Iranian politics, says Hossein Razagh, an Iranian journalist based in Europe, who represented the most prominent political prisoners in talks to organize the Congress. There was no leak. After demonstrating that disparate groups can work together, Razagh says, democratic activists will welcome the help of any country and any international institution that would help them for a peaceful transition, but not, he says, military intervention. Under the heading The World, Zelensky's Drone Diplomacy by Nandika Chatterjee and Richard Hall. And there's a small photograph at the top of this column. There's a blue sky. That's the enormous part of the small photograph. Very hazy in the background, mountains, gray-blue mountains. Then in the middle, a line of trees. They look still defoliated. And in the foreground, what looks like could be weeds growing, but it looks to me like a wheat field, part of which has been mown, and the other part of which is a fringe stemming from the ground. But in the sky above that field, there's something that looks like a dirigible on its side. In other words, it's probably a rocket heading upward. And it has some fins on it, and I don't know if I'm seeing wheels or just other rounded apparatuses that look like appendages. The caption reads, an interceptor drone on a mission in Ukraine, March 4. It was just over a year ago that President Donald Trump told Volodymyr Zelensky that he did not have the cards right now. Today, the war in Iran may have improved the Ukrainian president's hand. Iran's deployment of masses of low-cost drones to attack the Gulf and Israel, hitting oil infrastructure, U.S. bases, and apartment buildings, has exposed a critical gap in the region's air defenses. While the countries on the receiving end of those attacks possess sophisticated missile defense systems, like the U.S.-made Patriot, they have struggled to absorb the high volume of Iran's cheap, expendable one-way Shahed attack drones. Ukraine has been fighting off those same drones for years. Ukrainian officials say Russia has fired tens of thousands of Shahed-type drones at its cities since Moscow launched its invasion in 2022. Out of necessity, Ukraine has developed a multi-layered network of drone defense that is suddenly in high demand. It combines radar detection, electronic jamming, interceptor drones designed to hunt down Shaheds mid-air. Ukraine's expertise in this area has given Zelensky a diplomatic boost at a time when his country's armed forces are under pressure on the battlefield, and the U.S. has been pressing him to accept unfavorable ceasefire terms with Russia. Zelensky told Britain's parliament March 17 that 11 countries, including the U.S., had asked Kyiv for help in combating the drones, that 200 Ukrainian military advisors were already in the Middle East, offering advice on how to defend against them. Agreements are already in place, he said. In a briefing in Kyiv, March 14, Zelensky said President Trump himself had expressed an interest in purchasing Ukraine's drone defense technology. Zelensky does not intend to give away this expertise for free. He has said Ukraine is open to long-term deals that grant access to its drone defense in return for money and other weaponry its armed forces might need. Despite growing international interest in Ukraine's anti-drone technology, Trump has publicly downplayed the need for Kyiv's assistance. "We do not need their help in drone defense," Trump told Fox News Radio in an interview March 13. "We know more about drones than anybody." In a CNN interview March 15, Zelensky was asked if Trump's remarks suggested some resentment toward him. "I don't know," he responded. "Middle East countries and American bases, they need interceptors. It's drone interceptors. It's new technologies. It is our technology." The brief opener, Q&A. This is a question and answer format. "Could Iran retaliate on U.S. soil?" Written by Connor Green. After the massive U.S.-Israeli air assault, Iran retaliated militarily across the Middle East, firing missiles and drones into a dozen countries since February 28. But the regime also has a long history of mounting terror attacks. Asked in March whether Americans ought to worry about attacks at home, President Donald Trump told Time, "I guess." "While the threat is very significant," says John D. Cohen, who served as the Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis during the Obama administration, "the good news is that the level of understanding and sophistication, especially amongst U.S. state and local law enforcement, has increased dramatically over the last decade and a half." Time spoke to Cohen, as well as Bruce R. Hoffman, a counterterrorism and insurgency expert who has served in advisory roles to multiple federal agencies, about what to know about the potential threat Iran poses. Question: "What capability does Iran have to attack the U.S.?" Answer: Cohen. "Iran has created a global cyber attack capability, working closely with countries like Russia. It also has an extensive presence in Canada, Mexico, Central America, South America." Answer by Hoffman. "Over the decades, there have been reports and in some cases arrests of Iranian sleeper agents in the United States. However, over the past decade plus or so, it seems those assets, if they did exist in the U.S., have atrophied." Question: "Compared with other wars the U.S. has been involved in, how is the threat different this time around?" Answer by Hoffman. "Terrorism is now seen as one of many other threats to the United States. Consequently, over the past 8 years or so, we have seen resources, especially following the defeat of the ISIS caliphate, shifted away from counterterrorism to counterintelligence and to other threats." Question: "Are there scenarios you think are more likely than others?" Answer by Cohen. "Experts that we worked with, they've always said, if you want to understand what Iran is going to do, look at what is being done to it. Iran is typically very careful not to go beyond the tactics that have been employed against it. So as we're looking at the current conflict, we're seeing the targeting of government officials. We're seeing the targeting of petrochemical facilities. Those are examples of what we did to Iran." Question: "Does Iran have the infrastructure or intelligence to replicate U.S. attacks?" Answer by Cohen: "Yes. While not on the same scale, Iran does have the operational capabilities to replicate many of the attack techniques used against it. It has an extensive global cyber capability. They have had over a decade to develop their playbook and incorporate emerging technologies such as AI and drones into their attack scenarios. Question, can you explain the threat of Iranian proxies to the U.S.? Answer by Cohen. Iran has strong financial and operational relationships with groups like Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, and even criminal organizations, where they will use these groups or operators associated with these groups to engage in acts of targeted violence or cyber attacks. Question. What capability does Iran have to carry out drone strikes on the U.S.? Answer by Cohen. Iran has a significant presence in Mexico, Central America, South America, Canada, even the U.S., through its military and intelligence operatives, its proxies, its relationship with criminal organizations, in particular those operating south of the border. They have the ability to access the expertise, the personnel, the equipment to conduct a drone attack in the United States. And now they have the incentive. Answer by Hoffman. Drones are easily transportable, so they could be brought into the country, smuggled across the borders. I think that there is a range of possibilities. Good question. What is the political cost of pricey oil in an election year? By Philip Elliott. If Republicans cannot get their arms around the spiraling costs of oil, they might need to get familiar with a new greeting. Hello, Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. The joint U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran brought the single biggest disruption to oil in history. Markets responded rationally with panic. A gallon of gas was up almost 50 cents in the first week as the White House offered confoundingly mixed messages about when this war might end or what would be considered a victory. The metric President Donald Trump offered on March 13 for the war's end, when he feels it in my bones. Republicans' hopes of holding on to their slim majorities in the House and Senate may end up hinging on the cost at the pump when voting starts in just a few months. And the math is pretty clear. There is a correlation between the cost of oil and losses endured by the party running the White House. The pattern can be seen going back half a century. The government's own energy think tank is warning costs are going to stay up at least into 2027. In the last three midterms in which the price of oil was adjusted for inflation, hovering around or above $100 a barrel at this point in the cycle, the party in the White House lost 29 House seats on average, according to a Time analysis. Speaker Mike Johnson can't afford to lose just one vote to keep his gavel. Trump's salvation may be that it is only spring. When oil prices slide lower as it gets closer to Election Day, as they did in 2014 and 2022, wave elections can end up blunted. But the numbers we are seeing now offer little comfort for GOP strategists hoping to ride out this Middle East turmoil. They have gone up probably less than I thought they'd go up, Trump said March 9, as he faced a brutal grilling about oil prices that could upend the economy and the last 2 years of his political power. The calendar year began with oil at $57 a barrel. Analysts warn it could triple that by the end of March if the Iran conflict continues to clog the Strait of Hormuz, a route that sees about one-fifth of the world's crude oil production. Republicans cannot help but notice the peril. In 2010, oil in today's dollars reached $113 in March of that midterm. Democratic President Barack Obama saw his party lose 64 seats. 4 years later, things looked just as bad for Obama when crude that March hit $132 in today's money. Oil prices fell closer to Election Day, but Obama lost 13 more seats. Trump's last midterm election in 2018 was more of a mixed bag. At this point in the cycle, oil was at just $79 in today's dollars, but prices rose from March to September, when voters start paying attention to elections. Trump lost 42 allies in the House, but picked up seats in the Senate. Nimble messaging cannot mask the hard truths of commodity prices. Senator Majority Leader John Thune conceded March 9, the price of gas is always kind of a benchmark, and said politicians need to hear voters' concerns. But there was not much that could be done about it with the Strait of Hormuz impassable. To be fair, presidents typically get disastrous midterm report cards from voters. Since the Great Depression, only two midterms have shown positive trends for the party in the White House. The impeachment-weary 1998 electorate let President Bill Clinton's party pick up four House seats. And the post-9/11 2002 midterms gave President George W. Bush a net 8 seats. Otherwise, the history is a parade of solid rejections of the party in power. In this election cycle, the greatest unknown may be not Trump's metrics, but Iran's awareness of the pain it can do economically. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, embraces asymmetrical warfare. That's asymmetrical warfare. Closing the strait has figured in its battle plans for decades. Experts warn that even if mines are removed, Iran may find other ways to unsettle the maritime insurers who ultimately decide where ships venture. March 11, an IRGC spokesman said, expect oil at $200 per barrel. Well, here's a photograph that I will read the caption for after I try to describe it. It's about half a page, and there's a lot of green here, a lot of green bushiness and forestry, and an asphalt two-lane road runs through the green vertically. Most of the green looks horizontal. And then there's this vertical road. And then across the road going horizontal, it looks like a big blob of lava or black ash or cinder. And a tiny strip inside that big blob, which is also running horizontally across the photo, is red. Burning Bush is the title. Lava makes its way through a forested area and across a road near the Piton de la Fournaise volcano in the southeast of the French overseas island of Réunion. March 13, the volcano has been erupting since February 13, spewing two lava flows that have cut off the national highway linking the south and east of the Indian Ocean Isle that is home to 900,000. Also, I should mention that at the bottom of the photograph, running towards us, running toward the camera, this is an aerial view, is a person on that asphalt road. I don't know how the guy got across that lava flow bed, but here he comes. The bulletin, after youth-led protests, Nepal votes for Rapper to be next leader, and Rapper is R-A-P-P-E-R. This is by Chad de Guzman. Balendra Shaw, a 35-year-old rapper-turned-politician, could soon be Nepal's next prime minister after his party won a sweeping parliamentary majority in March 5 elections. Shaw's Rashtriya Swatantra Party, RSP, formed 4 years ago, dominates the lower but more powerful chamber, having secured 182 of 275 seats. Kathmandu's former mayor, more popularly known as Balen, B-A-L-E-N, campaigned on being unbeholden to the Nepali political establishment. The RSP's rise is a marked shift for the small Himalayan country of 30 million, wedged between India and China. Power in Nepal has largely rotated between major parties for decades, but discontent over perceived corruption among political elites boiled over in September when young Gen Z protesters took to the streets and stormed federal buildings. At least 77 people died in the violence, and then Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli was forced to resign. Shah stands out among Nepali politicians, not only for his signature black rectangular glasses, but also for his roots in hip-hop, reportedly inspired by American musicians Tupac Shakur and Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. While pursuing studies in engineering, Shah was already making an impression in Nepal's hip-hop scene, both online and on the streets, in the early 2010s with lyrics reflecting Nepali social issues like poverty and income equality. Shah's tenure as mayor of Kathmandu from 2022 to earlier this year was defined by a massive cleanup campaign that earned him both praise and criticism. His anti-establishment, confrontational approach to governance made him the face of the protests last year, which he said he backed. Sujeev Shaikya, who chairs Kathmandu-based think tank Nepal Economic Forum, says he expects that as Prime Minister, Shah will take transparency to a different level. Here's the milestones page. Past, PASSED, Housing Bill in the Senate by Connor Green. By an overwhelming bipartisan vote of 89-10, the Senate passed a sweeping piece of legislation March 12 that seeks to bolster the U.S. housing supply and lower costs for home buyers. If the 21st Century Road to Housing Act passes the House, it would be the largest housing package to be signed into law in decades, although it faces an uncertain path because of opposition within both parties. The primary objectives of the bill include relaxing regulations to boost home building, mitigating costs for homeowners and buyers, and prohibiting institutional investors from buying single-family homes, a move that resembles President Trump's January executive order directing a similar ban, though experts have said it is likely to have limited impact on reducing home prices. The next article is longer, One, W-O-N, an Oscar for Dural Arkapaw, pioneering cinematographer, by Eliana Doctorman. I'll spell the person's name. An Oscar for Durald, D-U-R-A-L-D, Arkapaw, A-R-K-A-P-A-W. There's a photograph here of this individual. The person looks young, slender, wearing black, a long black coat with an interesting texture. I can't tell if it's brocade or patchwork. A white shirt, a black tie, either a dress or a jumper underneath that black coat. The person has black hair with a part in the middle. It appears she's wearing earrings. I can see only one ear. And is holding a statuette of the Oscar. Autumn Durald Arkapaw made history at the 98th Academy Awards March 15 when she took home the Oscar for Best Cinematography for Sinners. Only three women had previously been nominated in the category, all of them in the past decade. Rachel Morrison for Mudbound in 2018, Ari Wegner for The Power of the Dog in 2022 and Mandy Walker for Elvis in 2023. I really want all the women in the room to stand up, Durald Arkapaw said. I feel like I don't get here without you guys. Best cinematography was a tight race this year. Many predicted a win for One Battle After Another's Michael Baumann, who received the American Society of Cinematographers' top prize earlier in awards season, an honor that has been preceded and that has preceded an Oscar win in six of the past 10 years. The world of cinematography is even more male-dominated than directing. In 2025, women made up 13% of directors of the 250 top-grossing films, according to a study by San Diego State University. Just 7% of the cinematographers on those films were women. So when presenter Demi Moore read Durald Arkapaw's name, the reaction in the room was electric. In her speech, Durald Arkapaw thanked pioneering women in her field, including Ellen Kouros, who shot Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The award also recognizes the Sinners cinematographer's own pioneering achievement as the first female cinematographer to shoot on IMAX 65mm and Ultra Panavision, which includes wielding two gigantic and incredibly loud cameras. Durald Arkapaw dedicated much of her speech to Sinners writer-director Ryan Coogler, whom she called a very honorable person. The two previously collaborated on Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Before that, Durald Arkapaw worked on the Marvel Cinematic Universe TV series Loki, which earned her an Emmy nomination. She is slated to work with Coogler again on his reboot of the X-Files TV series. As her name was announced on Oscar Sunday, Coogler ran to the back of the Dolby Theater to find her son and carry him down the aisle to watch his mom's speech from up close. And at the bottom of the page, five additional categories with just thumbnail sketches. Displaced. More than 1 million people in Lebanon, nearly a quarter of the population, they were forced from their homes as Israel struck the Tehran-backed Hezbollah militia as part of its war on Iran, announced a diagnosis of early-stage breast cancer for White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, March 16. Wiles, 68, said she will continue working while undergoing treatment. Named an English artist born Robin Gunningham as the man behind guerrilla street artist Banksy by a Reuters investigation published March 13. Banksy's reps did not immediately confirm or deny the claim. Attacked Old Dominion University in Virginia and a synagogue in Michigan in separate incidents that occurred hours apart March 12. In the school shooting, one victim was killed and two injured. Sentenced 15 men to life in prison by a Moscow court March 12 for a 2024 attack at a Russian concert venue that killed 149 people, and for which the Islamic State claimed responsibility. The brief, health. Five symptoms neurologists say never to ignore by Angela Haupt. It can be hard to wrap your head around all the conditions neurologists treat. Cerebrovascular disorders like stroke and carotid artery disease, seizure disorders, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and frontotemporal dementia, headache and facial pain disorders, movement disorders including Parkinson's, muscle diseases, sleep-related conditions like narcolepsy, and much more. If there's a nerve somewhere, a neurologist could get involved, says Dr. Andrew Dorsch, Division Chief for General Neurology at Rush University System for Health and a neurologic rehabilitation specialist. And there's nerves everywhere in the body. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with the nervous system, and it can take quite the detective work to figure it out. Often, he adds, people brush off neurological symptoms for a long time, pinning their symptoms on age-related aches and pains, or assuming they will resolve on their own. That could be a mistake. We asked 4 neurologists which symptoms you should never ignore and what they might signal. Okay, here we go. The 4 neurologists are going to be talking about 5 symptoms. Weakness in one hand or leg. If you're dragging one leg behind you or have trouble writing with your dominant hand, schedule a doctor's appointment. People come months after their symptoms start, but weakness is one you cannot ignore, says Dr. Luis Cruz Saavedra, a neurologist with Memorial Hermann Health System. A lot of people think, oh, it's just a pinched nerve. But it could actually be a stroke. It could be a brain tumor. It could be a disorder like multiple sclerosis. It could be any sort of brain inflammation. Problems with speech. Stroke is a major cause of death in the U.S., yet people often delay seeking care. I hear all the time how someone's having stroke symptoms, and their reaction is, well, I'm going to take a nap and see if they go away, says Dr. Enrique Lira, director of the Division of Cerebrovascular Diseases at the University of Iowa. One way these urgent symptoms manifest, trouble speaking. People might start slurring their words, speaking slowly, experience difficulty finding words, or even be unable to comprehend what others are saying, Lira says. Difficulty getting out of a chair on a regular basis. As people get older, they tend to develop problems with daily movement. Some complaints stand apart, however. If you are regularly having trouble getting out of your chair, it is a good idea to schedule a doctor's appointment. Sure, there could be some joint issues, but we really want to take a look and make sure you do not have an issue with your muscles or your nerves or your spinal cord, Dorsch says. That's something I would want a family member to go get checked out. Persistent muscle twitches. Everyone's muscles twitch from time to time, usually at various locations. If you experience these fasciculations in the same place consistently, however, it is worth bringing up to your doctor, says Dr. Alexandru Olaru, a neurologist at University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. It is possible you could have benign fascicular syndrome, which is harmless, or a more serious condition like spinal stenosis or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And the last one, a sense of deja vu. Everybody experiences deja vu, the uncanny sense that something has happened before from time to time. But if you're having episodes of deja vu on a regular basis, you probably want to come in and get checked out, Dorsch says. That is because it could be a warning sign for a temporal lobe seizure. Dorsch recently treated a patient who was having recurring episodes every week or every couple weeks, which is not how often people usually get deja vu, he says. The View, this is the Nation heading, The Science of Skepticism by Nubar Afeyan, who is the founder and CEO of Flagship Pioneering and co-founder and chairman of Moderna. Scientists once thought illness was caused by miasmas, foul vapors that drifted through the air. For centuries, they were certain that the sun rotated around the earth. Till the 1950s, they believed lobotomies were the best way to treat mental illness. Why did we stop believing these things? In each case, skeptics used the scientific method to produce data that disproved the incumbent theory. They hypothesized, experimented, observed, analyzed, iterated, then published the results, precipitating a shift in our collective understanding of the world. Doubt and debate are the prisms that test current ideas and help generate new ones. Perhaps then it is good that it is now more popular than ever to be skeptical of science. Yet this most recent wave of skepticism is different. Its loudest voices are making evidence-free claims about COVID, climate change, and vaccines, presenting personal opinions as though they are facts, with no regard for experiments or data, makes a mockery of the scientific method. This is profoundly dangerous. The scientific method is the most powerful tool humans have to change the world. It is how we together convert the unknown to the known, resolving uncertainty and productively metabolizing scientific doubt when it arises. At its best, the scientific method consigns the worst fates that befall humans, debilitating illnesses, devastating diseases, to history. It heals the sick and feeds the hungry. Science makes miracles. American investments in science turned our country into the world's economic, technological, and military superpower. According to an estimate from the National Science Foundation, as much as 85% of all U.S. GDP growth since the end of World War II is attributable to advances in science and technology. The computer or smartphone you may be reading this on would not exist but for the scientific method. The banana you ate for breakfast would have been wiped out by a devastating crop disease years ago, and the flu you had last week might have presaged your funeral this week. Without science, we would all be poorer, sicker, and less safe. If the scientific method is corrupted, we will not just stop making new miracles, we'll undo the proven discoveries of the past. Consider, for example, the increasing rejection in certain quarters of the science that led to mRNA vaccines and many childhood vaccines. Who's to say the same pseudo-arguments will not apply to life-saving cancer treatments or to anesthesia or to germ theory? It might sound alarmist to suggest we could regress to 1900. When the average life expectancy in the U.S. was just over 47 years, and pneumonia and influenza were the leading causes of death. But consider that measles, a deadly disease that was declared eliminated in this country in 2000, will formally lose that designation if the 1,362 cases documented in the U.S. since the start of 2026 continue to spread in the weeks ahead. For context, there were 2,283 confirmed measles cases reported in the U.S. in all of 2025. Reported confirmed cases in the first 2 months of this year are already over half that number. Ignoring the overwhelming evidence of vaccine efficacy is an abandonment of the scientific method. At the same time that some in the U.S. are undermining the scientific method, the Chinese government has been investing heavily in it. In just the past decade, China has increased its spending on the scientific method through a 400-fold increase in biopharma research and development spending. China now treats a higher share of global biotech patents than the U.S. and has a similar number of novel medicines under development. I'm wondering if patents was supposed to be patients, but I read it as printed. Biotech patents than the U.S. and has a similar number of novel medicines under development. If we can continue to discredit the scientific method, the U.S. risks becoming an innovation desert, reliant on other countries for new medicines and technologies, and helpless to protect our own people in times of crisis, ranging from biological warfare to the next pandemic. Even more terrifyingly, we risk our health. We risk not having an answer when disease strikes and losing infants and children to diseases their vulnerable bodies are not yet mature enough to withstand. We risk missing out on the next genuine, evidence-backed scientific revolution. We can choose to keep our miracle machine running. We can insist that skeptics express their doubts through the scientific method in the best tradition of history's most respected scientists. Or we can continue to abandon the scientific method and throw a wrench into the gears of science, damning ourselves to a future of disease, deprivation, and decline. The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer, contributing editor. This may be abbreviated for time constraints. As the world watches the still unfolding U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, the government in Venezuela, a regime now much more amenable to accommodation of President Trump, looks to find new footing. The remade leadership is working with Washington to revive a long stagnant economy, and there's early progress to report. In March, Trump moved to formalize American recognition of the administration, led by Delcy Rodriguez, a now pliable veteran of the old regime, by restoring U.S. diplomatic ties, which had been severed in 2019. The move not only opens the door to a normalization of Venezuela's foreign policy, it could also allow the government to access long locked up assets abroad, like $4.8 billion in gold, now held at the Bank of England, and about $5 billion in drawing rights from the IMF. Though a restructuring of Venezuela's debt remains a distant prospect, Washington's formal recognition does bode well for private sector engagement with Rodriguez's government. Higher oil prices driven by the war in Iran might also boost Venezuela's recovery. One additional early sign of stability, Trump now refers to Rodriguez as the president. For now, the Trump-Rodriguez working relationship leaves Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who famously gifted her 2025 Nobel Peace Prize to Trump, out in the cold. Machado has promised to return to Venezuela in the coming weeks, though she does not appear to have Trump's blessing to make this move. In the meantime, her refusal to engage with the Rodriguez government will further strain her relationship with the U.S. president. She's also publicly questioned the legitimacy of U.S.-backed economic reforms approved by Venezuela's current National Assembly, which risks alienating a segment of Trump's MAGA base that says Machado is in the way. Though Machado was banned from the 2024 presidential election, voluminous evidence indicated her party's surrogate candidate handily defeated then-incumbent Nicolás Maduro, who decreed victory. Machado remains the most popular figure in Venezuela, and credible polls suggest if a national election were held today, she would defeat Rodriguez by more than 2-1. And she's not the country's only opposition figure. Enrique Marquez won less than 1% of the vote in 2024, but the ruling party is much more likely to negotiate with him than with Machado, making him a potential alternative. Marquez was also an invited guest at Trump's State of the Union address, a sign the White House is willing to throw weight behind figures they believe can facilitate a smooth transition. Marquez and others will have time to build their political profiles. The U.S. State Department has reaffirmed Washington's commitment to a phased transition to a democratically elected government in Venezuela, which would help allow the new government to secure major new investment from abroad. But Trump's immediate focus on economic stabilization suggests new elections probably will not happen before the second half of next year. If the Rodriguez government can sustain a pragmatic working relationship with Trump, the vote could be put off even longer. In the meantime, she will try to manage a gradual political opening that establishes credibility with Washington and other foreign governments without throwing the ruling party and the country into more political turmoil. It is also possible Rodriguez has a long-term political future. For now, any Venezuelan national election that is legitimately free and fair would produce an opposition victory, but recent polls put Rodriguez's approval rating at 37%, not far from the 40% threshold that incumbents around the world typically need to win. And if Venezuela's economy finally picks up steam and the opposition remains as divided as it has been in the past, a Rodriguez win becomes conceivable. That was abbreviated only slightly, and we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia for the Reading North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.